VOA News, I'm Tommy McNeil. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports that a federal judge in Virginia has sentenced former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort to nearly 4 years in prison for bank and tax fraud.
A federal judge imposed the 47-month sentence after Paul Manafort addressed the court, saying he feels humiliated and ashamed. He says in solitary confinement, he had time to reflect on his actions and hopes to have an opportunity to show the world who he really is. Manafort was prosecuted as part of special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, but this case is unrelated to his work for the Trump campaign.
That's AP's Jackie Quinn reporting. The House broadly condemned hate after an anti-Semitism dispute. AP correspondent Mike Rossia.
Before the vote, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi addressed recent comments from freshman Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, who suggested politicians who support Israel have dual loyalties.
We support Israel out of friendship, out of shared values, but also because it is in our national interest to do so.
But White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway blasted Democrats for going easy on Omar.
Speaker Pelosi today couldn't decide whether Omar is an anti-Semite or if she's stupid, since she said, well, she really didn't know what she was saying. She really didn't understand the import of the words.
The final vote in the House was 407-23, passing a resolution condemning anti-Semitism and other bigotry. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Chinese tech giant Huawei has sued the U.S. government, arguing the legislation Congress passed last year restricting its business in the United States is unconstitutional. The case, which analysts see more as a public relations move, is the latest in an intensifying effort by the telecommunications company to fight U.S. security concerns that Huawei argues are unfair and unfounded. In the lawsuit, Huawei argues that Section 889 of the National Defense Authorization Act violates the constitutional principles of separation of powers and due process. This is VOA News. Hundreds more men, women, and children trudged out of the last corner of the Islamic State self-declared caliphate in Syria Thursday, increasingly defiant that the terror group's defeat was imminent. And even as Islamic State militants are losing the last of their territory in Syria, the top U.S. commander for the Middle East says they remain dangerous. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
They're down to holding less than a single square mile in Syria, their physical caliphate nearly gone. But General Joe Votel says the remaining militants are defiant.
Unrepentant, unbroken, and radicalized.
Telling a House committee they're simply going to ground and waiting for the right time to come back. And the world needs to figure out how to handle them.
This is a serious generational problem that, if not handled properly, will sow the seeds of future violent extremism.
Votel's testimony provides a reality check to President Trump's repeated claims that the Islamic State group has been defeated. Sagar Magani at the White House.
The commander of U.S. forces in Africa has cast doubt on whether the Pentagon will complete plans to cut forces in Africa by 10%. As the Department of Defense announced late last year. In November, Pentagon officials said that they would cut roughly 700 of the 7,200 U.S. troops on the African continent by June 2020. The reductions, officials said, were to optimize special operations forces that would be needed in the potential future fight against near-peer competitors like Russia or China. The International Monetary Fund called Venezuela one of the most complex situations it has ever seen. IMF spokesman Jerry Rice Thursday described Venezuela and its economy as a combination of food and nutrition crisis, hyperinflation, a destabilized exchange rate, debilitating human capital and physical productive capacity, as well as a very complicated debt situation. Rice said that tackling the challenges is going to be taking a long time to and strong resolve and broad international support from all 189 IMF members. Civic and governmental organizations across the world are preparing to recognize and celebrate International Women's Day on Friday. International Women's Day is more than a 100-year-old celebration of women's social, economic, cultural, and political successes worldwide, while also calling for gender equality. More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, March 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today's International Women's Day, and Africa leads the world in women's participation in parliament.
As in previous years, Rwanda continues to hold the top spot in the rankings with more than 61% of women parliamentarians.
That's VOA's correspondent Lisa Schlein in Geneva. South Africa's third party challenges the country's political order. Zambia's Rights Commission calls for reconsideration of the suspension of a private television station. Guinea-Bissau holds parliamentary elections this Sunday. And Zimbabwe defends hiring a Washington lobbyist for $500,000 to lift sanctions.
What I can only say is that Zimbabwe is leaving no stone unturned in its efforts to ensure that the illegal sanctions imposed upon the nation are removed.
Nick Magwana is the permanent secretary in Zimbabwe's Ministry of Information, and Gambians demonstrate against the mass deportation of Gambian migrants from Germany. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. March 8th is International Women's Day, and this year's theme is Think Equal, Build Smart, Innovate for Change. Activists see women's participation in government as one way to bring about global gender equality. An article last month put Rwanda as the country with the best record for female representation in parliament, with nearly two-thirds of its seats currently held by women. Two other African countries made the top 10, Namibia with 46% and South Africa 42% women representation in parliament. Alyssa Schlein reports from Geneva. The Inter-Parliamentary Union finds that more women around the world are winning seats in their national parliaments, with the best gains being made in countries that have well-designed quota systems.
The report finds women's representation in national parliaments rose by nearly 1% last year to 24.3%. This may seem a modest increase, but this figure indicates an ongoing upward trend of women's participation in politics since the 1995 World Women's Conference in Beijing. At that time, only 11% of women were in parliament. Their share has now more than doubled. IPU Secretary General Martin Chungong says he also is heartened by the greater diversity in the makeup of women's representation in parliament.
We are seeing more women of native origin. We're seeing more women of color coming into parliaments around the world. And if we take the United States, for instance, we saw a noticeable improvement in parliamentary diversity with Native Americans making their inroads into parliament, women of color increasing their share of parliamentary representation. And we even see the entry into parliament of two Muslim women.
Chungong notes the United States shot up in the global rankings of women parliamentarians from 137th position in 2017 to 79th place last year. The survey finds women now occupy about one quarter of all seats in both houses of Congress. As in previous years, Rwanda continues to hold the top spot in the rankings with more than 61% of women parliamentarians. Two other African countries, Namibia and South Africa, are in the top 10. The IPU finds 65th-ranked Djibouti made the most dramatic gains regionally and globally among lower and single chambers. It says the share of women in parliament rose from nearly 11% to more than 26%. The report says the Americas continue to lead all regions in terms of the average share of women in parliament with 30.6%. This compares to the Middle East and North Africa, with the lowest regional average of slightly more than 18% female parliamentarians. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Zimbabwe government is defending its decision to hire a Washington-based lobbyist for $500,000 to campaign for the removal of targeted sanctions imposed on top ZANU-PF officials. But human rights activists criticize the deal as a waste of scarce resources in a country where more than 5 million people are food insecure. Nick Magwana, permanent secretary in Zimbabwe's Ministry of Information, says the sanctions are retarding Zimbabwe's development and affecting ordinary Zimbabweans.
What I can only say is that Zimbabwe is leaving no stone unturned in its efforts to ensure that the illegal sanctions imposed upon the nation are removed. So we are doing everything that's possible, everything that's legal, to make sure that the livelihoods of Zimbabweans are improved. We can only do so if we can trade freely, if we can be able to sell our minerals at the appropriate price on the open market, rather than to go using third parties and so forth, losing money and buying things and selling at a premium. It doesn't work. So we need sanctions removed. So as a nation and as a responsible government, we are deploying all these efforts to ensure that we can achieve the aspirations of Zimbabwe.
But Mr. Mangwana, government critics are saying that this is a waste of money because the country is facing a severe drought. Why pay lobby firms?
It's not a waste of money to ensure that investors invest in your own country. It is not a waste of money to ensure that our goods can be sold at the right price on the international market. It is not a waste of money to ensure that our bankers and our banks can also secure finances on the international market at reasonable interest rates. It's not a waste of money to ensure that our agriculture is well-funded, our mining sector is well-funded, and we have investment coming into this country. We have skills transfer in this country. When we put money to ensure those things are happening, that's what money wasted. But if we want to talk about waste of money, it's a waste of money to board a plane, to fly all the way to Washington, to call for sanctions to be imposed against your own country. It is a waste of money to be creating fake news, even videos, even some other props, which paints the country as a very unstable country, as a country which is a jungle. That's a waste of money, but not the way the government is deploying the money right now. I think that's appropriate.
Nick Mangwana is the permanent secretary in Zimbabwe's Ministry of Information. He spoke from Harare with Blessing Zulu of Viewers Zimbabwe Service. But Jeff Smith of Vanguard Africa says the Zimbabwe government paying $500,000 to hire a lobbyist for the removal of targeted sanctions is an indication that there is something wrong with Washington.
I think in summation, it really is a very apt manifestation of all that is wrong with Washington, D.C. at this point. You know, you have this lobby firm with obvious close links to the administration representing one of the more repressive countries, not only in Africa, but in the entire world. This is a government that has opened fire on its citizens in the streets. It has brazenly disregarded regional and international human rights norms and standards for four decades now. Many people will point to the fact that there's a new president at the helm, but lest we forget, he's been there, or was there, rather, by the side of President Robert Mugabe for nearly four decades. So this is nothing new in terms of the dispensation in Harare, but definitely a new development in terms of the battleground and their new allies here in Washington, D.C.
But Harare is alleging that the sanctions are illegal and they were merely imposed because of the land reform program, and it has nothing to do with the issue of human rights.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that they're couching the sanctions in terms of illegality when, in fact, this agreement with Ballard Partners may in and of itself be illegal, given the sanctions regime on the targeted individuals in Harare. I think we would be a fool to assume that this agreement is merely between Foreign Minister Moyo. It really is an agreement with the government of Emmerson Mnangagwa, who himself is a targeted individual under the United States sanctions.
Jeff Smith is director of Vanguard Africa. He spoke from Washington with Blessing Zulu of Viewers Zimbabwe Service. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, March 8th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. The Zambian Human Rights Commission has called on the country's independent broadcasting authority to reconsider its decision to suspend the broadcasting license of Prime TV, an independent television station. The Rights Commission says freedom of expression and media freedom are key parameters of assessing a country's human rights and good governance record. The IBA suspended the license of Prime TV for 30 days after the ruling Patriotic Front Party accused the station of biased reporting. Mwiwa Muleuya is the spokesperson for the Zambian Human Rights Commission.
We are deeply concerned at the development of suspending the broadcasting license of Prime TV. We have been engaging both the Independent Broadcasting Authority and other stakeholders with a view of ensuring that that decision is rescinded. We are engaging government because we believe that that is an issue of human rights, that people have the right to access to divergent views and opinion, and the private television station has been playing that role in a very effective manner. If the government felt that they must have breached any of the regulations, we believe the suspension of its broadcasting license for 30 days, it was extremely excessive, and they should have considered other forms of engaging the private television station and allow it to continue broadcasting while monitoring its adherence to the state regulation.
Mwila, some people are saying Prime TV is on record to have violated the rules within which it was set up to operate. So the suspension would serve as a deterrent to other independent broadcasting stations who violate the rules or the laws governing independent broadcasting in Zambia. How do you react to that?
To the contrary, that will really send serious signals of state repression, because there are still concerns as to how the Independent Broadcasting Authority is executing its legislative mandate of regulating the private broadcasting houses. And we are glad that the Permanent Secretary of the Information Broadcasting Ministry has stated that the Independent Broadcasting Authority will also start regulating the public broadcasting station in order to be fair. And that's a concern of the Human Rights Commission, that the laws must not be selective, that you cannot only be regulating the private broadcasting houses, but you are leaving out the public broadcasting houses. So that's one of the serious concerns we have as a Human Rights Commission, that we need equal protection and benefit of the law. And the law must be applied without any form of discrimination, regardless of any form of affiliation or views.
Is the Human Rights Commission therefore saying that the application of the law in suspending Prime TV is selective?
In this case, we are saying there are also other complaints relating to the national broadcaster. But also we are saying that a punishment of 30 days is very excessive in our view.
Mwiwa Muleya is the spokesperson for the Zambian Human Rights Commission. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from the capital, Lusaka. Parliamentary elections are scheduled for this Sunday in Guinea-Bissau. The country has suffered a political crisis in past years with a deadlock between the president and a split parliament. Carlos De Silva, a civil society activist, tells Ricky Stryak about how the country is preparing and what voters are hoping for after the polls.
Things are going quite well so far, and today, this morning, military and the police, they stored in the vote. They started voting this morning. They want to be free on Sunday, you know, to ensure safety and security. That's why they started voting this morning. Everything, the campaign, election campaign is going so good so far, and you know, major incidents and things going democratically well as it is, as people were expecting.
What is at stake in these elections? What, with the country having that long period of paralysis, what are the hopes of your group anyway that these elections bring forth?
The hope is, since 3 years and a half ago, the country went on a crisis. It was when the president decided to step down the Domingo Simoes Pereira. Since that time on, the country is blocked. You know, the situation is blocked and everything is blocked. And that's creating a lot of difficulties, financial difficulties and so on and so on. And it created a lot of crisis around the country in all sectors. We've seen different strikes in the education sector, health sectors. But now the international community, they freeze every funds they have promised Guinea-Bissau, and they have blocked everything, and the people are suffering. So people expecting that with this election, everything will be blocked. Everything will come quite normal. People will start get the funds and the country will start working. And people will get a better life and so on.
In order for that to happen, though, the PGC would probably have to win a majority of the seats. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's it. Because people are feeling now that if the PGC doesn't win with majority, the problem will persist because this other party that will make another coalition and they will block the PGC program in a national assembly, and the problem will persist and the people will keep suffering. That's what people are fearing now. And, you know, majority of people want that PGC to win with the majority so they can secure the peace in the country, the stability.
Carlos De Silva is a civil society activist. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Guinea-Bissau's capital, Bissau. The spark that lit the fire of South Africa's increasingly popular far-left party started in 2012 on a windswept hill near the Lawman Platinum Mine in Marikana. Police that August shot dead 34 striking miners. The party born soon afterward, the Economic Freedom Fighters, is the first third party to seriously challenge South Africa's political order since the end of apartheid. Viewers Anita Powell visited the community where it all began and asked them what they see in South Africa's political future.
The dusty mining town of Marikana is perhaps best known for its darkest day, the 2012 police shooting of 34 striking mine workers. But anger over their deaths planted the seeds of the Economic Freedom Fighters, the far-left party that could bring an end to the African National Congress's grip on power. This year, as they approach their second national election, the EFF stands a chance of making real gains in ANC strongholds. Already, the party has come to dominate university politics, winning student elections late last year at the universities of Johannesburg, Cape Town, and Zululand. In adult politics, the party also won key municipalities in the 2016 vote. EFF ward councillor Wendy Pretorius represents the undeveloped area of Wonderkop, which contains the hill where miners gathered in 2012 to strike against conditions at the Lawman Platinum Mine. Pretorius said she was an ANC supporter until police fired on the strikers, and President Jacob Zuma declined to meet with their widows.
So we were singing, waiting for the president of the country, Jacob Zuma. And Jacob Zuma, he never pitched. We were singing and waiting. And then instead of coming to the mountain to see the people and to hear the side of the story, what's happening, he just went to the hospital, to the management of Lonmin. After that, he go back. So it's where we started to say, you know what? It seems like we are not belong here at South Africa.
Critics of the EFF have denounced its leader's fiery, sometimes race-baiting rhetoric, its far-left policies, and its habit in its early days of getting into violent scuffles in Parliament. But in the past year, the party has encroached on the ANC's traditional base, South Africa's poor black majority. Marikana resident Nomkhulisi Mafalwana says EFF representatives have brought positive change. Pretorius, she said, helped set up a community project in which mine workers' widows sell chickens to improve their meager income.
EFF has made a good change. He's driving us. Because this place is not a place that you can see that there is a people who live here. It's a place that who live pigs, not people.
The movement is also gaining supporters in urban areas, where adherents have marched for free university education and assistance for upwardly mobile young South Africans. Here at the University of Johannesburg, which has nearly 50,000 students, the EFF took over the student council for the first time this year. Chairperson David Rapunga says the EFF strives to redress South Africa's historic inequalities, beginning by taking back land that was seized centuries ago by European settlers.
When you have land, you are able to nationalize. Nationalize your banks, can nationalize your mines. All the resources and the profit that are going to come back to the people, that are going to benefit the people of South Africa, Africa, and other parts of the world at large.
Rapunga says at the end of the day, EFF supporters want what was promised to all South Africans when the apartheid regime fell in 1994, a stake in their nation's potential. Anita Powell, VOA News, Marikana, South Africa.
A major demonstration was held Thursday in the Gambia against the mass deportation of Gambian migrants from Germany. The deportees had over the years traveled through the risky Mediterranean Sea to get to Italy, Germany, and elsewhere in Europe. Thousands of West African migrants have died during the perilous journey to Europe. Pandere Umbaya reports.
The scene at the commercial town of Serekunda, Westfield, where activists converged to condemn the recent deportation of Gambian migrants from Germany. The protesters have accused the Gambian government of receiving aid money from the European Union in exchange for the deportation of our citizens, a charge the government has denied. Government spokesman Ibrahim G. Sankare, in a recent statement, says the Gambian government has neither signed any deportation memorandum nor received any monetary rewards from any European country, as being continuously alleged by what he called these detractors. The protesters say they want to see an end to the deportation of Gambian migrants in Germany. Some of the deportees had their asylum cases rejected. The main man behind the demonstration is Omar Saibo Kamara, a political science student at the University of the Gambia.
We are calling on President Barrow and his government to engage Europeans, especially German and Italy, regarding our plight and welfare. Despite the international guidelines set aside on the issue of deportation that we all know, Gambia can engage Europe to reprioritize, renegotiate, and stop deportation.
Close to 2,500 Gambian migrants are said to have been lined up for deportation from Germany. Deportation planes have been shuttling between Germany and the Gambia in recent months.
Our Gambians abroad are committed, hardworking, and dedicated. They want to be given the chance to work and get integrated in Europe and will learn new skills for the next 5 years or more. This will enable them to work and contribute effectively to the socio-economic development of the country.
Some of the deportees said they arrive home with their hands and legs handcuffed. They also arrive home empty-handed, leaving their belongings behind. Dudu Kinte is one of the Gambian deportees who are taking part in Thursday's protest march.
Since why I'm here today, I just came to demonstrate, because not for me, I'm already here, but at least for the brothers back here, because we all understand the situation of this country, how hard it is. If you are in this country without having anybody abroad to support you, it's very difficult. I belong to a very, very large extended family. I'm the only one supporting the family with my brother. So today I'm here. The situation should happen to somebody else. So we are urging the government. They are the one who signed this thing. Enough is enough. Let them now stop it.
Kinte says he received an amount of 60 euros from the International Organization for Migration, IMO, upon arrival in Banjul. He expresses disappointment at the Gambian government, saying that there was no government official pressure at the airport to receive them. He says they were processed at the old tarmac of the airport by some Gambian immigration agents. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandere Umbaya reporting.
And that's it for this Friday, March 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, including Carl Sterling, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good weekend.
Hi, this is Rick Pantaleo. On our next science edition of Press Conference USA, we'll talk about Ebola, the current outbreak of the virus in the Democratic Republic of Congo, as well as a new medication that shows great promise in treating all three deadly strains of the Ebola virus. That's the science edition of Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an exclusive interview with the Vice President of Malawi, Saulos Chilema. The Malayan politician and VOA's Shaka Sali discuss democracy and the upcoming elections. An in-depth look at Malawi's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.